What's up, everybody? Welcome to the newest episode of Celluloid Fever Dreams. We're back after a 7-month hiatus. I keep saying we, but it's still just me. Even the rabbit kind of up and left. If you're wondering, you've forgotten why I had to take a hiatus, or this is your first episode, and you didn't know I'd even taken a hiatus, I'll give you a little quick update. Right after my previous episode, which was Stockholm, my partner of 16 years and I decided to call it quits. Nothing salacious, nothing, controversial, just we had grown apart and was kind of living parallel lives for a couple of years through most of the pandemic. So I've spent the past few months, getting divorced and finding somewhere to live and getting everything turned on and, getting up the nerve to record again. But I can safely say I've reached a point emotionally and creatively and financially that I'm in a spot where I can start the podcast up again. So here we are at the beginning of season 3 of Celluloid Fever Dreams. So I'm going to go ahead and warn you, I'm probably a little rusty, so this episode may not be up to the standards of previous episodes, but I'm going to try to get my feet back under me as quick as I can. This week's film is from 1998, stars Reese Witherspoon and Tobey Maguire, and it's called Pleasantville. As always, we start with our 3-second synopsis. 50s sitcom stuff with a moral message happens. For a little bit more of a detail, here's the synopsis from IMDb. Geeky teenager David and his popular twin sister Jennifer get sucked into the black and white world of a 1950s TV sitcom called Pleasantville and find a world where everything is peachy keen all the time. But when Jennifer's modern attitude disrupts Pleasantville's peaceful but boring routine, she literally brings color into its life. So recently I was online and following a discussion where people were talking about older films that they didn't think could be made today. And of course, the first one that always gets thrown out is Blazing Saddles. If you're a longtime fan of the show, then you know my opinion on it, because I did an episode on Blazing Saddles last year, in which I basically have the opinion that no, Blazing Saddles would probably be easier to get made today, because that kind of humor and way that it's told is pretty much common nowadays. I mean, back in the time when Blazing Saddles was made, 1974, 75, Mel Brooks had to fight in order to get the fart jokes put into the film because they were considered to be too offensive for audiences of the time. And to me, it's always interesting to go back and watch older films and see what wasn't considered as taboo at the time versus what they consider taboo now. Like I said, Blazing Saddles, they had to fight with a studio over cowboys farting around a campfire. But, while I had some downtime, I was watching some films. I watched Jodorowsky's El Topo and The Holy Mountain. Really weird, trippy films. But, like I said, you have this one R-rated film that they're fighting to include a fart noise. And you got these two films where children are just running around naked. Bit of a shock. I'd already been warned by people that both of these films were kind of trippy. And if I remember right, John Lennon and his wife, Yoko Ono, helped fund one of them. I'm not sure which, and I'm not really going to waste the time to look it up just now. We're not talking about that film. But, little things like that you just sit and think, they didn't have a problem with this, but you had a problem with fart jokes. And we're going to dive into a little bit more in Pleasantville, some of the things that... where the sitcom that they're sucked into is taking place in 1958, some of the things the filmmakers had to deal with in order to make that setting feel a little authentic a little later. But back to my original point, I know I've wandered a little bit, but I really think Blazing Saddles would be easier to get made today because, again, we're used to that kind of humor, we're used to those kind of jokes, we're a little bit more open to what Blazing Saddles would be. But I think a film like El Topo or The Holy Mountain would be a harder sell today to a studio than it was even back then. And in my opinion, another film that you would have a hard time getting made today, or, you know, getting into a theater to make money, would be this one, Pleasantville, which is really weird because when the film come out, it was, you know, pretty innocuous. I mean, it wasn't seen as controversial to my memory, and from what I could find out on the internet, you know, most people marveled at the special effects, at the, you know, mixing of black and white characters in a setting with characters that were colorized, like Ted Turner had been doing throughout the late 80s and 90s with older films. And, you know, just, you know, people talked about the story and the performances in it. But nowadays, looking back at it and watching it through, you know, like I said, to today's world and today's political climate, oh my God, this film would just be a lightning rod. Political pundits on both sides of the aisle, and it might sound weird to say that, but let me just get into it. Like I said, the plot of the film is two kids from the late 90s get thrown into a 1958 television series where everything's in black and white, everything's solved within a half hour, there's no real conflict, there's nothing sexual, you know, no dirty words or anything. It's, you know, it is the 50s image that we've all been fed of how, you know, the world was then and seen in those old time TV shows. And then with their modern attitudes and exposing people to things outside of, you know, their current existence, they modernize it. They bring everything up into, you know, color and expand their minds. And when they first arrive there, all the books are blank. They're just, you know, prop books like you'd find on a TV set, but then they start talking of stories, and the books that they did know the plot to, they would talk about them and the books would fill up. So, you know, they bring change to the world. So I could just see this coming out now and seeing some, you know, conservative pundit just, you know, frothing at the crotch, talking about how the liberal Hollywood machine is no longer hiding its agenda, that you've got these, you know, liberal kids that were sent back and they destroyed America when it was great, and this is what, you know, this is the future that they want, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's the easy take. I mean, that's a no-brainer take. I mean, you can watch the film and just immediately you'll key into all of that. But honestly, across the aisle, you know, on a more leftist side of it, a more liberal side of it, this film would also bring down some controversy today. There's images in the film, elements of the story, that are lifted from the civil rights movements of the 60s, deliberately. You know, like I said, the whole premise is, you know, the town goes from black and white to in full color. So once that starts happening to some of the citizens, you start seeing signs around town like, you know, no colors allowed and things like that. And in fact, the courtroom scene near the end of the film is shot very much like the scene, the courtroom scenes in To Kill a Mockingbird, in that the people all sitting on the ground floor are the citizens that haven't changed yet, and all of those who have changed and are in full color are relegated to the upper balcony and have to watch the trial as it goes on. Now, the reason I say that this would generate some controversy from, you know, the left side of the political spectrum is the fact that, you know, having this message and having the no colored signs and lifting some images and elements from the civil rights movement, but having a cast that's as white as the driven snow deliver that message would definitely bring it open to discussion and controversy and, you know, people condemning it. And I'm not going to delve into that because I'm a middle-aged white guy from the South, and I'm not really the one in a position to talk about how that message was handled or whether it should have been done this way or not. But I do think it is something that could be discussed, and I could understand why it would be. Now, the writer-director of the film, Gary Ross, has gone on record in interviews and behind-the-scenes things saying that the film isn't specifically about race in America and isn't specifically about racism in America. It's the theme is oppression, but not in All right, let me back up. To him, the film is about oppression. It's about how when individuals begin suppressing the things about themselves that make them unique, you know, suppressing their interests, suppressing their opinions, suppressing, you know, what makes every one of us, then it becomes easier for society at large and for governments to oppress people because we've already gotten used to doing it ourselves. And he says, and that's the overall message of the film and the way that he approached it, that only by being true to ourselves and being ourselves and growing as people can we change society as a whole. Now, is he effective at delivering that message that way? Honestly, I think at first glance, it does come across as more of a anti-racism film. But reading the comments and watching the film again, I see where he is coming from with it. I mean, I don't think it may have been executed in the best way, but I do see what he's talking about because, you know, like in the synopsis, like I said, it's Jennifer, played by Reese Witherspoon, whose modern attitude begins changing the town. But the thing is, she remains black and white, and her brother, David, remains black and white until they themselves change the way they are. You know, it's not like they land in the middle of a 50s sitcom that's all black and white and, you know, they're in full color like, you know, a modern television show. No, they're black and white and they take over the roles of two characters in the show. And it's only when Jennifer, who's, you know, pretty much party girl, starts to become a little more studious and realize there's more to life and more to her than just, you know, being a popular girl, then she gets her color back. She's changed as a person. David, when he lets go of wanting to control everything and everything being perfect, and you know, learns that he too, you know, that change is normal and that he's going to change as he gets older, then he gets his color back. So yeah, hearing him say that, it becomes much more obvious. I think it's a little bit muddled in its execution. But let's talk a little bit about the cast and crew. This film is just completely overloaded with talent. I mean, just character actors and actors and actresses just starting out that went on to have a bigger career in Hollywood. It's just amazing to watch this film and just catch everybody that you recognize in it. We'll start off with the writer-director. As I mentioned, it's Kerry Ross. This is the first film that he actually directed. He also directed Seabiscuit and The Hunger Games, The Free State of Jones, and Ocean's 8, which came out in 2018. He's also the writer behind Big, Dave, the 90s Lassie film, and The Tale of Despero. And as I mentioned, he also wrote this film and Seabiscuit and the others. David, who's our main protagonist, is Tobey Maguire, who, of course, his most famous role is probably at this point Spider-Man. His most recent role is in the film Babylon, which also stars Brad Pitt and Margot Robbie, and is about the Hollywood studios and basically the beginning of Hollywood back in the 20s. He's also had roles in The Great Gatsby, Seabiscuit, SFW, Empire Records, Cider House Rules, Boss Baby. His first role, I was kind of surprised about this, his first role was as a bully in The Wizard back in the early 90s. His twin sister, Jennifer, who, when she lands in Pleasantville, is renamed to Mary Sue. Make of that whatever you will. Is played by Reese Witherspoon, whose first role was in the film The Man on the Moon when she was Man in the Moon when she was 14 years old, early 90s. I didn't write the year down. You can see her most recently at the time of this recording in The Morning Show, which is on Apple TV and co-stars Jennifer Aniston. She has done a ton of films, and honestly, I think Pleasantville, to me, looking at her career, like mid-90s up to like the mid-2000s, like 2005, 2006, is like peak Reese Witherspoon. In fact, my three favorite movies with her all come out and around this point. It's including Freeway, Election, this film, Legally Blonde, Sweet Home Alabama, Walk the Line, Sing, Monsters vs. Aliens, Just Like Heaven, and small roles in like American Psycho. But yeah, seriously, like Freeway, Election, Legally Blonde, honestly, probably three of my favorite films that she's ever done. And funny enough, I mentioned that if this film come out nowadays, it would probably be a lightning rod for conservative thinkers. At the time of her filming this, Reese herself was a registered Republican. I don't know if she still is, but it does kind of make me wonder how her attitude of the film then versus now might be. Now, the teens are sent back in time through the use of a magical remote control, which was given to them by a TV repairman played by Don Knotts, who is pretty much a comedy legend. Well, I ain't gonna say pretty much. This man is a comedy legend. The most famous role he's gotten, of course, has got to be Deputy Barney Fife on The Andy Griffith Show, which actually started in 1960, so a couple of years after this. But honestly, it kind of surprised me when I read that, because I've always thought of Andy Griffith as a 50s TV show. You know, it's a wholesome humor, down home sort of sensibilities. And it's a show that's still funny nowadays. And I'm not just saying that because I grew up and live just like an hour outside of Mount Airy, which is where Andy Griffith was born and raised, and which was the basis for Mayberry and the show. It's, Andy Griffith still holds up. It's still shown like 5 days a week here on a local channel. And I think part of it is because it's well written. It doesn't have some of the goofiness and the sweetness that some of the other sitcoms of the time had, and the humor isn't them being goofy. There's goofy situations, but like Barney Fife, you know, he's the sidekick, and he does have some goofy things about him. He'll clean the jail and accidentally lock himself into it. His gun's got a hair trigger on it, so he doesn't keep bullets in it. But there's a depth to his character that Don Knotts brought out as well, and the writers brought out as well. You know, he's active in his church. He's a good singer. He's the lead of the choir. He's a good friend. You know, there's more to him. And I think that's why the show sort of, I still like it, and it's still watched nowadays, is all the humor comes from the characters and their personalities and their interacting with each other. And I'm off on a tangent again, but let's talk a little bit more about Don Knotts. Like I said, Andy Griffith, the show, launched him into popularity, and he had several films come out in the mid-60s. He was in The Incredible Mr. Limpet, The Ghost of Mr. Chicken, The Shakiest Gun in the West. In the 70s, he teamed up with Tim Conway for the Apple Dumpling Gang movies for Disney, and they also reunited in the 80s for The Private Eyes. On television, he's done, as I said, Andy Griffith Show. He's on The Tonight Show back in the 50s. His first acting role was in the TV show Search for Tomorrow in 1951. And in the late 70s, early 80s, he took over the role of the landlord on Three's Company, Mr. Furley. He also did the Scooby-Doo movies and Matlock, where he teamed back up with Andy Griffith. This would be his final live-action acting role, Pleasantville. From there on, he did a lot of voiceovers and things like Cats Don't Dance and other films. His last role was in Air Buddies in 2006, and he passed in 2008. And again, talking about how times have changed, one of the core plot points of Three's Company, a sitcom which ran in the late 70s and early 80s, was a man had to share an apartment with two women. They all roomed together. But the only way he could get the apartment was he had to convince the landlords, who were first an older couple called the Ropers, and then Mr. Furley, when he took over, that he was gay. That was the only way that they let him stay in the apartment, because if he was straight, then they may get up to, you know, nasty things, sexual things with the two girls that lived there. Yeah, imagine that sitcom today. But yeah, let's give a quick rundown of some of the other actors in it. When I mentioned that this thing's top-loaded with talent. The TV dad in Pleasantville, that David and Jennifer's TV dad in Pleasantville, is played by William H. Macy, whose most recent role of time of recording is Maybe I Do, and whose first acting role was in the soap opera Another World in 1982. He's also been in just a ton of films. I'm just going to hit some highlights. The Last Dragon, he had a small role. Benny and June, Fargo, Boogie Nights, Mystery Men, which I absolutely loved him in. Magnolia, Jurassic Park 3, The Cooler, Seabiscuit again, Thank You for Smoking, and also the television series Shameless. George's wife, and Jennifer and David's mother, is Betty, played by Joan Allen, who most recently be seen in Licey's Story, which is based on, I think I'm pronouncing that right, it's based on a Stephen King novel. Pretty good one, I've read it. Her first role was in A Wedding, which was a TV movie. I don't know, I scribbled that or dropped something on it. Anyway, she's also been in things like Compromising Positions, Manhunter, which was the first film with Hannibal Lecter in it, Peggy Sue Got Married with Kathleen Turner, The Ice Storm, which also had Tobey Maguire in it. She was the wife of John Travolta's character in Face Off. She's been in The Notebook, The Bourne Ultimatum. Mr. Johnson, who's David's boss and who winds up having an affair with Betty in the film, is played by Jeff Daniels, most recently seen in American Rust. First role was an episode of the television series Hawaii Five-O, and he's probably most famous for the Dumb and Dumber movies with Jim Carrey. But he's also been in films like Ragtime, Terms of Endearment, Radio Days, Arachnophobia, Gettysburg, Speed, Squid and the Whale, Looper, and The Martian. But some of the other actors you may recognize from include J.T. Walsh, whose first film was Eddie Macon's Run in 1983. He's also been in things like Hannah and Her Sisters, Tin Men, Good Morning to Vietnam, Misery, Backdraft, A Few Good Men, Blue Chip, Outbreak, Sling Blade, Breakdown, and Hidden Agenda. He would die shortly after this film come out of a heart attack. Hidden Agenda would be his last film. Really good character actor. He's one of those people you'll recognize him if you see him. And I can't say I've seen everything he's done, but he is one of those everything I've seen him in. I've enjoyed his performance in it. We'll do a quick shout out to some other people you may recognize, blink and you miss them kind of moments. Jane Kazimarek, who you may recognize as the mom from Malcolm in the Middle. Jenny Lewis, who's now a singer, but who also starred in Wizard. Paul Walker, of course, from the Fast and the Furious movies. This was one of his earliest roles. Maggie Lawson, who most famous for the TV series Psych. Mark Blucas, who had an arc on Buffy as one of Buffy's boyfriends. Marley Shelton, who would star in Bubble Boy opposite Jake Gyllenhaal just a few years after this. And I didn't see her, but Jenna Fischer, who played Pam on The Office, has said on the podcast she does with does on The Office, a little behind the scenes things, that she has a small role as a glorified extra in this film. I don't know, I may have just overlooked her, but if I was going to lie about being in a film and just a small sort of role or just an extra, I'm not sure Pleasantville would be the one that I would pick to do that with. But as I said, visually this film is just crazy. There is, it's almost like a reverse Wizard of Oz, in that you start out in modern day. We start out in 1998, and everything's in color, and then it jumps back to the 1950s, 1958, if we're to believe the calendars in Pleasantville. And then the color starts seeping in, as Jennifer and David start mentioning the way that the world should be, starts bringing new concepts to it. And so as the film moves on, you start to see more and more people and more things around town becoming saturated with color. And it's very striking. And just some of the shots are just amazing. And especially because you found out, I always thought that the film was shot in black and white, and then they went back and digitally colored everything was supposed to be in color. And it turns out that no, they did the opposite. They filmed everything in color and then went back and desaturated all of the film stock in order to get the black and white look. And anything they need in color, they just left in color. This film actually has almost, at the time it was released, I believe, if my sources may not be right, but at the time it was released, it had more digital effect shots than any film in history. In fact, it took the Star Wars film, Phantom of the Menace, again, if my sources are correct, to finally break the record of most digital shots in one film. The only exception to this I could find in doing research on the film is there's a scene where Joan Allen has become saturated with color, and she wants to hide this fact, so she puts her makeup on, and she's just gray makeup on her face and her hands and everything, and Jeff Daniels wipes it off, so you get to see her color come through as he's telling her how he feels about her. And for that shot and that shot alone, they put her in green makeup to match a green screen so that they could make the color. I don't know why they wouldn't put her in gray makeup. I didn't see anything on exactly why they chose that, but it was so they could give her the right color scheme, and then as he wipes the makeup off, you would see her actual skin color starting to come through. Another little fun fact, if you want to pay attention, the neighborhood that David, Jennifer, and George and Betty live in is the back lot that has a ton of classic sitcom houses in it, including houses from Gidget and Leave It to Beaver, Bewitched, just a bunch of sort of blink and you miss it moments as they're driving down the street. And not just sitcoms. If I can't remember which house, I didn't write it down, which character it was. I want to say it's the house that David and Betty wind up living in while they're there, is the Murtaugh house from the Lethal Weapon films. And if you're a fan of classic sitcoms, like I said, you'll catch that. But I'm also amazed by how much detail they went into to just drive home the fact that this is a sitcom. This isn't 50s America. The fire department exists only to get cats out of the trees. There's never been a fire. The police department doesn't really do anything. There's no toilets in any of the bathrooms. Which is crazy, because you think about it, even in the 50s, they did scenes in TV shows where people went into the bathroom. But if you pay attention, they never show a toilet. You'll see a shower, you'll see a bath, you'll see a sink, a mirror, but you'll never see a toilet. The closest classic television ever got to showing a toilet was actually an episode of Leave It to Beaver, where Wally and the Beav, which is the main character, caught a crocodile, no, alligator, they wanted to raise it as a pet, and they were hiding it in the tank of the toilet because they knew it needed water. So you got to see the very top of the tank of the toilet as they put the alligator in and out. But they didn't allow you to see the toilets. The networks wouldn't let you see a toilet on television in the 50s. In fact, even up through the 70s, it wasn't until 1971 and All in the Family sitcom that you heard a toilet flush on television. The Brady Bunch, this is another one that sort of blew my mind. Six kids in one house, sharing a bathroom that sat between their two bedrooms. You had three kids in each bedroom. There wasn't a toilet in that bathroom either. In the 70s, even in the 80s, Married with Children did a lot of humor about the bathroom and toilets and stuff like that. But it just wasn't something that was shown a lot on television. So the scene in the movie where Jennifer runs into the bathroom and realizes there's no toilets, that's pretty much true to life. Well, true to sitcom life in the 50s. And to me, that's why Don Knotts being in this film is so brilliant, because especially for people of a certain generation, especially like my generation, my parents' generation, Barney Fife, Andy Griffith is one of those all-time classic shows. So to have him be the one who, sends the two of them back, even if, this small role, the TV repairman, is just brilliant stunt casting, because that's the role. And I'm old enough, I remember Mr. Furley in Three's Company. Couldn't think of the title for a second. But again, I grew up on Andy Griffith. So, despite the fact that I love his films, love seeing him in this, to this day, every time I hear Don Knotts' voice, loved him in the Scooby-Doo episodes that he did. The first thing I think of is Barney Fife from Andy Griffith. So, to me, this is, it's stunt casting, but it's stunt casting done right, because he evokes everything that he should in the role. And it's the other thing that sort of throws me is that he gets so frustrated at one point, you actually get to hear Don Knotts drop the F-bomb for what I'm, I, for what, to my knowledge is, and from my research, the only time he used language like that in a role. You know, so for someone like me, who, you know, grew up with Barney Fife, you know, grew up seeing animated Don Knotts on a Scooby-Doo and, you know, Mr. Furley and just all this stuff that I could watch with my parents, sort of family friendly, to hear him drop an F-bomb in this film is just mind-blowing and amazing. So, you know, Pleasantville is, like I said, it's a beautifully shot film. There's a sequence, and I don't want to spoil it, but there's a sequence where you see a tree just explode into flames, the first fire that the town has ever had, and to watch this brilliant orange and red fire explode out of this otherwise black and white world. There's some beautiful shots in it. Obviously, they did their research to make sure that it was, you know, as true as it could be to the 50 sitcoms. The message handling, I mean, there's nothing subtle about it. I mean, I'm just going to put it like that, but it doesn't feel like it's, I guess, bludgeoning you over the head with it. You know, they're not subtle about what they're trying to do, but they're being very entertaining with it. I mean, every time I watch the film, I just get sucked into the story, and it doesn't feel preachy. It just feels natural. And like I said, the other thing I loved about it is the fact that the protagonists, you know, they're not perfect. They have to learn to change. They have to earn their color and become better people as well, which, you know, is not something that I think you see a lot of times in films like this. So, you know, it sort of brings up to the point of course, the part of the episode where we ask the most important question of all. Was it entertaining? Yes. I honestly, you know, like I said, a film that, 25 years ago at this point, was just seen as something, you know, fun, you know, to watch, just go out and have a good time, in a way, not, I won't say a brainless film, but just something that was very entertaining and not all that daring or shocking at the time. To watch it nowadays, in this political climate, and to just see it and filter it through, you know, modern lens, is a very interesting experience. And like I said, it is an entertaining film. I love the story. There's so many talented actors in it. So many good moments. Honestly, it's a movie I have to recommend. In my opinion, it's one of the best ones that Reese Witherspoon ever did. William H. Macy and Joan Allen and Jeff Daniels and the triangle that develops between them. I can't recommend this film enough. I just love it. I love the film. Love everyone in it. If you get a chance, go out and watch it. If you want some places where I own the DVD, so I just watch it whenever I want to. But if you don't have that option and you want to check it out, you can rent it on Amazon, Apple TV, YouTube, Vudu, Redbox, DirecTV. You know, it's out there if you really want to check it out. And I do recommend that you check it out. So what are we watching next week? Well, if I can locate it, because I've been kind of searching for it online, and I'm going to see if I can maybe get a physical copy of it if I can't find it online in the next couple of days. It's the film Officer Down, which is a action comedy with some over-the-top moments in it about a cop that the department refuses to let die. He keeps getting killed, but they have machines that put him back together and send him back out there to blow up criminals and make the streets of LA safe. And when I say over the top and sort of maybe, I'm going to say even maybe gratuitous violence and such, one of the scenes in the trailer shows him fighting against nuns with guns. It's like a criminal gang that dressed like nuns. I've been wanting to see this film for a while because the trailer just makes it look like a really just fun but weird experience, and I can't wait to watch it and share it with you guys. So until next time, as always, there's a lot of things you can choose to be in life. Kind is one of the better ones, especially to yourself, because you deserve it. You're a good person, and well, I hope to see you again here next week. But until next week, I have been Wyndham Jennings. This has been Celluloid Fever Dreams, And I'm going to be saving you a seat. So go out and have some fun and find something interesting to watch. See you later, everybody.